This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9. The Business Station. 6 o'clock now on Thursday, the 14th of September. I'm Melissa Idris, and I'm going to be keeping you company all the way till 10 o'clock.
Well, Melissa, welcome back in the morning run.
Well, thank you very much. That was Brian Fernandez keeping me company here in the studio. Brian, I have to say, it's quite good to be back behind the mic, though. But it's
even at this unearthly hour.
Yeah, it is a bit ungodly, but you know what? It's been a while, so please go easy on me today while I kind of ease back into it. Let's start, shall we, with a look at what's happened overnight. News out of the US, we've got news following Hurricane Irma that 6 people have died in a Florida nursing home. It was left without power for days, so police had to evacuate 115 residents from this facility because the air conditioning had gone out, was cut by the storm. And I think this just adds to the death toll. I think more than two dozen lives have been claimed from Hurricane Irma, and that's not including the trail of destruction that that the hurricane left in the Caribbean. 40 people were killed.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we always talk about is how the small number of deaths are highlighted in an advanced economy, but yet the large numbers in places like Bangladesh and all that literally get a footnote in all these articles.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The cost of life is not equal sometimes in the eyes of the media. Moving on, we've also got news that the Olympic Games have been, the host for the Summer Olympic Games have been named. So Paris and Los Angeles will be hosting the 2024 Olympics and 2028 Olympics. So Paris 2024, LA 2028.
And this is the first time they've announced two venues at the same time.
Yeah, and you know why? Because LA wanted to host 2024, but then they said, okay, we'll wait an extra 4 years because the International Olympic Committee promised them more funds. So they said, okay, we don't mind waiting if you're going to give us more money.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's the story for the Olympic Games. We've got the names of the host cities. And moving on closer to home, there's news that the Sarawak Chief Minister, Dato' Abang Johari Openg, well, he has come out to put to rest any speculation that Sarawak will provide temporary housing for Rohingya refugees fleeing Myanmar. And he's saying that he doesn't want to get involved in this issue. Personally, this caught me a bit off guard because I wasn't sure where this was coming from. I didn't see any news reports saying that Sarawak was going to house.
Obviously, perhaps doing the back channels.
Something must
something
have happened.
Must have happened.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. And for all us car drivers out there, we've got retail prices for RON 95 and RON 97. Both prices have gone up for the next week. RON 95 is up 1 cent to RM2.21 per litre. RON 97 up 4 cent, Brian, to RM2.14. Bit of a jump.
Well, this mirrors global oil prices, and which have been firming up over the last couple of weeks.
So, okay. So it's reflective of
that. It's reflective of that.
So all prices are valid until next Thursday. Diesel also up quite a big jump from RM2.05 to RM2.14. So there you go. Commercial vehicles might be hit by that. 6:04 right now. We'll be back in just a few minutes to take a look at whether in-person conversation is better than texting. Yeah. Well, we will see then. More after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Rory Gallagher there with Off the Handle. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with the always charming Brian Fernandez.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Brian, now I have to ask you, are you a person who prefers in-person chats or texting on the phone?
Oh, definitely. I think it's in-person chats. I think, which is very unusual compared to, say, a millennial, I think, who they all prefer texting.
I don't know whether I would be considered a millennial. Maybe borderline millennial. Okay, well, millennial-minded, shall we just say. But I do have to say, there are pros and cons, and I think it's a matter of picking which is more suitable for the occasion, right? So, for instance, I do prefer communicating by text. Because I think it's less disruptive, less intrusive. So, you know, you text someone, you WhatsApp someone, you don't, you know, you don't expect them to answer right away. You think, okay, if they're busy or in a meeting, they'll respond when they have time. I also do think there's a time and place for in-person chat. So sometimes I probably wouldn't text something that, you know, something sensitive or something that could be lost in translation, I would rather say in person.
So, okay, I think I have to make a distinction between wanting to communicate with person face-to-face and at the same time, or texting them. So, for example, after 9 o'clock, I have a rule where I always text the person first.
Is that 9 a.m. or 9 p.m.?
9 p.m.
Oh, okay, so in case they might be sleeping.
They may be sleeping or it's inconvenient. So even if it's a close friend, I will do that. For business conversation, mm-hmm. before calling someone, I will always WhatsApp them and say, hey, is it all right for me to call you now? Or what's a good time to call? It's just manners and politeness that's developed over the years. I think, again, social media doesn't mean you have to be rude.
Right.
Okay. And also sometimes if to follow up on a conversation, on especially a business conversation, face-to-face or on the phone, I will then WhatsApp them back and say, hey, it was great talking to you just now. This is what we discussed.
Is this like black and white?
Yes, absolutely. So I use it, perhaps maybe because I'm a little bit older, I tend to still think in terms of, especially for business conversation, let's just recap what we agreed upon.
Well, that's very clever, I have to say. I don't know, do you think that's redundant though? Because you're texting someone before you call them. Why don't you just text it?
Well, the key thing is this, you don't want to disrupt people's lives.
Sure.
So that's that whole philosophy of trying not to intrude. But I know that that a lot of people just prefer the text.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is just WhatsApp and so forth. It's a lot easier. I mean, I have a very good friend, for example, who's unwell. Unfortunately, he's suffering from cancer.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And he's in Singapore. I don't call him anymore. But we communicate purely on WhatsApp because he's undergoing treatment and stuff like that. I don't want to intrude because I don't know what state he has. Good days, he has bad days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we communicate.
Well, fair enough. I mean, that's a really good example of you don't want to be intrusive in someone's life, especially someone who's going through so much.
Yes.
But, you know, we came across this video. It was a short interview by Sherry Turkle, who's the director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. And this was done at the Aspen Ideas Festival. So she argues that there needs to be a space in everyone's home and life where there are no phones at all, that perhaps in-person conversation is better than texting. She says she's not anti-technology, she's pro-conversation.
Pro-conversation, that's right. And to be honest, I agree with her point of view. If you see what I just described, see how I just described my interaction with people, it's not as if I'm discounting technology. I'm
right.
using it to complement my life. And to still have that immediacy and also that relevance. However, in this case, I agree with her because what I see now, especially among younger people, is there's so much reliance on the technology, they can't even relate to each other face to face.
Oh, what do you mean by that? Can't relate to each other?
Because you see that there is a breakdown in terms of social skills. When people, for example, and you see this in restaurants all the time, couples sitting together, they're having dinner, but then they're on their phones texting. That whole relationship and eye contact, body language and all
right.
that, oh, it's all lost.
Well, you know, we've had years to evolve our senses to read body language, to read facial expressions and, you know, eye contact and gestures and all that. And it's really kind of all been disrupted by this texting technology, right?
Yep.
We no longer need to read people's reaction to something. And so often, you know, in a text, it could be misread. Sometimes I can't read sarcasm on text. I can't tell if someone's
yeah,
being snarky with
yes.
me on text. I do have to say though, Brian, that no phones policy would be great to implement. I've recently just implemented no phones on the dining table to all my friends and family. So as long as we're
That's
at the dining table, phones away.
That's a good thing.
It's coming up to 6:15 now. We've got Graceland by Paul Simon after these messages right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:22 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run with Melissa and Brian. That was Graceland by Paul Simon. Isn't that such a lovely tune to hear in the morning, Brian?
Absolutely. You know, just
so soothing.
Just for my generation.
I would say that's intergenerational because he's great at every point in time. Space, Brian, is the topic of our next conversation. It is really the final frontier. But given its start from the early days with the launch of Sputnik in 1957, the exploration of space has really been dominated by the Cold War and that rivalry between the USSR and the US.
Yes.
Now, the race is no longer kind of driven by government interests, but rather between companies. Really, it's the commercialization of space.
Yeah, so what happened is the following. So as you correctly pointed out, it started off really as a space race. It's about military. Then it became scientific, again, with government spending. So basically those two governments and then later on China spending money in order to invest and gain military supremacy. So lots of innovations came in from space exploration. However, then billionaires got into the act. So you had visionaries like Elon Musk coming in, and then people like Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, funding private enterprises. So now you have, for example, Elon Musk's SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, actually part of the US space program, commercially engaged to supply the International Space Station and other projects. Now we also then have Jeff Bezos getting into the act. He's got Blue Horizon. They are also leading a host of other companies in the next wave of investment. Today it takes about something in the region of $200 million to put a satellite on in space, mm-hmm. but that's come down a lot now.
So I have to ask you, is this a good thing? I mean, in context, right? Is it a good thing that space exploration is now being commercialized?
Yes, I think it is, because what's happened is it's brought down the cost of launching satellites. It's brought science closer and more accessible to people. What it's also done is, and it's built up a whole thing called a space economy. So this it's a new revenue stream for companies and potentially also other governments. Now, the space economy in 2016 was estimated to be something in the region of $329 billion, three quarters of which are from commercial activities. No longer, so the equation has now changed.
Okay.
So now, they have now the next stage of rocket launches where they're getting the price points down to something in the region of $5
million. Whoa.
And this is where the opportunity... There are 70 countries with space programs, Malaysia being one of them. But realistically, these small startups who are building this sort of commercial applications, this is where countries like Malaysia can get into the act. Not in basic science research, but really in the commercial part of it, and act as a springboard for building capacity locally.
So you mean Malaysian companies could get on board with the commercial?
Malaysian government, we have a space agency. Instead of spending money sending people to the moon or sending people to space,
to do their tarot in space.
Absolutely. let's be focused and say, hey, let's see how we can make some money out of this.
Fair enough. You know, this reminds me of a book that I read. It's called The Entrepreneurial State by Mariana Mazzucato. She wrote that, you know, essentially, the state is the biggest innovator of all, because did you know that the iPhone, Apple didn't design the iPhone? It was actually funded by the CIA.
Oh, that's interesting.
There you go.
Very interesting.
All right, it's 26 minutes past 6 o'clock. We've got Lonesome Street by Blur, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, If I Could Talk, I'd Tell You, by the Lemonheads there. 6:40, coming up to 6:40 right now on Thursday, the 14th of September. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez, if you've just joined the show. And if you've been living under a rock, you've probably have heard by now that Apple rolled out its new iPhone yesterday, iPhone 10. This comes a decade after the launch of the original iPhone. So, Brian, I guess the internet has had time to react to the launch. And as always, the iPhone has proven to be very divisive. I think generally on the internet, if you look at the comments and the reviews, there's two camps. There's the MacHeads camp, you know, the Apple lovers camp, and then there's the Apple haters camp. So do you fall into either one of these camps? Are you on the fence here?
I wouldn't consider myself an Apple hater, but I'm an Android user, I'm a Microsoft user, and Google. So basically, my bone of contention with Apple users is this. I can buy a laptop, a Windows laptop, for just over 1,000 ringgit. Okay, and it does everything that the simple users like me do. Journalists, you're writing stories and so forth. But then for an equivalent base Apple machine, it's four times the price. So, you know, it just, I can't make the logic out of it. I know it's beautiful equipment and user interfaces, but the gap is so small now.
Well, you know, Apple products, I mean, Apple, there's been several comments to say that Apple and its following is actually a cult.
It is a cult.
Because, you know, it's really got a huge following. We came across this one story from Sydney where a guy said he was going to queue up for 10 days ahead of the launch of the new iPhone.
So Melissa,
be the first to get it.
Melissa, when I first saw that question, I said, oh gosh, just who another cult guy? Follower, what? You know?
Why does he have to
Why
be
does
the
he
first?
Have to do this? Absolutely. But then when you read the article, you realize there was actually a method in the madness. So essentially, he's a YouTuber. So he has bragging rights for being the first person. I think the previous year he was the third person to get an iPhone in Sydney or something. So he has actually bragging rights for being the first to get an iPhone. It's going to translate to more money for him. It's going to translate to more fans for him. So basically, I think all that time is going to translate into a free iPhone
for him.
You
know, fair enough, Brian. But, you know, he's not the only one. Sometimes those queues go around the block, right? They snake. So what's the excuse of all the other people waiting for 10 days in line to get the new iPhone? I have to tell you, very few companies inspire such strong emotions, be it positive or negative, right? But I really wonder what it is about Apple that inspires such a strong reaction. Sometimes I think Apple is a bit of a religion because it has so much in common with a religion. If you look at Apple stores, Brian, for instance, it looks like a house of worship. You know,
the
clean design, the Apple logo, the iconic Apple logo is treated with almost a sense of worship. All of the products are put up on a pedestal or, you know, like an altar almost.
And then if you look at it and going on your theme, look at Steve Jobs. He's been made out to be this godlike figure. And he is such a charismatic figure when he was alive.
He is the supreme leader of Apple.
Absolutely. And the legions of followers follow him from within the organization itself.
What it is, I think, is it's Apple is selling something more than just a product, right? They're selling a way of life. And that's how I think I got sucked into the ecosystem. You start out with one product and then you realize it links to another product and another. So it's the iEconomy.
And you see, the thing is, you hit the nail on the head. Steve Jobs was the first guy to really figure out and then execute. I mean, Microsoft talked about it, but Steve Jobs executed the whole ecosystem. Mm. And then everybody else joined into the bandwagon. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why, yeah, you can't use an iPad in isolation because, you know, all your music is, if it's already on an iPod or so forth, you've got to migrate. And I think that's the clever thing that they've done. So a lot of people, the first conquest for Apple has been really music. So it was the iPod, then it became the iPhone. And then after that, they said, oh, okay, let me just put everything on. I switched from a Windows laptop to an Apple laptop. Mm. And after that, they never moved.
I think with every Apple event, I'm really fascinated with the tech fanaticism that surrounds it, right? There are the people who just are so loyal and support. And I don't want to use the word fanboys in a derogatory sense, but, you know, it's really fanaticism at its highest. But there's also the backlash to it. And you really see that. The people who say, oh, you know, it's not innovative. It's really not worth the price tag.
And this is the mind-boggling thing about it. So you look at a phone as a utility.
Right.
Okay, so very different for a lot of other people where it's a fashion statement. It's a statement that, oh, yes, I want... It's bragging rights. I want to... I've got the latest and the best phone. I look at it as a utility. It's got to do all my functions. I've got to read emails. Now, 4,000 plus ringgit for a phone is unbelievable.
Well, unless you know, you really use it more than just a phone. You use it almost like a computer. And I have to say, I met a tech journalist who works with The Guardian, and he told me that there is no subject matter that gets you more views and more comments than an Apple article. So it really, he gets it from both sides. Sometimes when he writes anything Apple, the clicks are through the roof. And it's really comments about, oh, you're not critical enough, or you're too critical. Really, you can't win. You can't win with this.
Wow.
There you go. 6:45 right now. We've got some tunes for you. So stay tuned right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:50 right now. That was I Want You to Want Me by Cheap Trick. We are no Cheap Trick here on The Morning Run, are we? I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez. Now, on to a more serious topic. Brian, a couple of days ago, the Sarawak State Government had put a proposal up for discussion. It's for the castration, using castration as a form of punishment for rapists. Now, this proposal was mooted at one of the high-level state meetings, and they say that it's part of efforts to combat the rising sexual crimes in the state of Sarawak, especially cases involving incest. So what we did was we spoke to Professor Dr. Azad Hassan Abdul Razak, urologist from the University of Malaya Medical Center, and we asked him to explain essentially the difference between physical and chemical castration.
Okay, the rationale for castration is to basically reduce the testosterone level in the body. This is a hormone produced by testes, and it is actually involved in the libido or the sexual urge of people. So by reducing the testosterone level, they're hoping that the libido will decrease. That is what the aim is. But I'm not sure whether this has been proven to work or actually deter others from doing it in future. So I don't think we have that evidence. There are surgical castration and medical castration, and I think that is a physical and chemical which you meant. So surgical castration is where you remove both the testes by a surgical method, whereas medical castration is giving medication to suppress the production of the testosterone, that's a hormone produced by the testes. In the case of surgical castration, it is irreversible. In the case of medical castration, it is still possible to reverse it.
Okay, so surgical is irreversible, medical still possible to reverse. But we also asked him if there are any medical concerns when it comes to using chemical castration as a form of punishment or prevention of rape.
I think the problem is testosterone is a very important hormone in the body, especially in the case of males. So testosterone not only plays a role in sexual activity, but it also plays a role in development and maintenance of bone and muscles. It also has an important role in the body metabolism. So low testosterone can potentially result in increased risk of diabetes and other cardiovascular diseases, especially if this is done at a young age. For example, let's say someone who is early 20s, you know, early 20s, the consequence, or the long-term consequence can be quite bad.
Well, Professor Azad also shared some of his thoughts on whether the Hippocratic Oath prevents doctors ethically from performing this procedure.
Okay, I think it will be very difficult for doctors to undertake a procedure for non-medical indications. So I think the doctors can refuse to do it. And because our main guiding principle is to do no harm first. So that is how we function. We do not want to do any harm to anybody unnecessarily. So that I don't think anyone can force a doctor to do it if they don't want to do it, especially this is a non-medical indication.
That was Professor Dr. Azad Hassan Abdul Razak, urologist from UMMC. So there you have it, a doctor's perspective on castration. I have to say, though, when I read this news article, I was a little taken aback by it a little bit, simply because it seems so radical a form of punishment. What do you think, Brian?
Okay, one of the things with castration is this, and he pointed out quite clearly, it's the surgical versus chemical. Surgical is irreversible, chemical is. Now, my point of view would be, just from a superficial level, just on that point alone, it should be chemical. Because what happens if, for example, someone is wrongly convicted of rape and evidence comes back later? You've ruined that person's life.
Well, that's right. Because irreversible procedures like that, like surgical castration, like amputation, the death penalty, even no human justice system is infallible. But I have to say, I mean, don't you think chemical castration also seems to be a bit radical of a form of punishment?
I also think we have to look at it far more broadly. Really, is that the reason? What are the fundamental reasons for rape?
True, because you know, chemical castration, punishment alone won't stop the rape culture.
Absolutely. What are the underlying reasons for rape? And there must be a complex number of reasons for it. we're not addressing the issue by doing this.
Rape is not about sex, it's about power. And I think rape culture should be tackled by teaching people how to show respect for women and children.
Absolutely.
And to be taught about consent, which is a conversation that we are not having as a Malaysian community. Yeah.
This is an easy way to sweep things under the carpet rather than addressing the real issues.
Exactly. Coming up to 7 o'clock, we've got the news bulletin up at the top of the hour. But first, here's Our Deal by Best Coast, right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 7 minutes past 7. I'm Melissa Idris with Brian Fernandez. I'm back in the hot seat after a bit of a sabbatical, as noted on Twitter by some people, Kevin and Robert Lim. Thank you for tweeting in. Yes, it's very good to be back on The Morning Run.
It's great to have a female voice in the studio at last. Okay, you know,
a bit of a boys' club.
A boys' club for a while. You know, when I joined BFM, and then until Joyce came in, that really helped to liven up things. You know, it's nice to have a female voice.
That's very sweet. But very quickly, let me give you a heads up of what's coming up on the second hour of The Morning Run show. In about half an hour or so, we're going to be speaking to our Australian market analyst, Ben Lebrun. He's going to be joining us on the line for a look at how markets have reacted to the new iPhone. And just before the 8 o'clock news, find out the 5 things you should know before investing in unit trust. We've got a series. This is part of our SC Invest Smart series. In fact, Brian, we've got a Twitter poll going at the moment where we've posed the question to listeners out there. What is your major concern prior to investing in a unit trust? Is it the fund manager? Is it return on investment? Cost of management fees? Or is it some other factor? And so far, 33 people have weighed in, with the bulk of the votes, 58%, picking return on investment.
So I think that for the bulk of people, I think that that's reflective of what I would expect the poll to be, that they would be concerned about returns. But it should be overall returns, not just gross returns, because a lot of times you have good returns, but then your fees, your front-end fees, as well as your ongoing fees by the fund manager is very, very high. So that lowers your overall return. In fact, some of these unit trusts, if you don't look carefully, they give you less than EPF returns.
All right, so there you go. We're going to be telling you more about investing in unit trusts, what you need to know before you make that decision. That's coming up all in the next hour, so stay with us. But Brian, looking at the news this morning, in fact, there's been news in just the past few hours that Aung San Suu Kyi is set to miss next week's UN General Assembly debate. This kind of ahead of all the criticism of her handling that Rohingya crisis has really grown in the past couple of weeks.
Yes, and again, for a Nobel Prize winner, this is really something that is animating across the world as to, does she really still deserve that award? Should it be revoked? I think that's really a point of discussion. And I think from her not attending that UN General Assembly, she hopes that perhaps the heat will be taken off the whole thing.
Exactly. Well, you know, we spoke to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, who's the resident host of BFM's Night School, and he shared a little bit about what he thinks about the calls to rescind Aung San Suu Kyi's Nobel Prize.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of moral leadership, it doesn't really matter what prizes she's had or what, you know, position she occupies. I mean, currently a genocide is taking place, and all evidence points to the fact that the military is responsible and complicit, and she is an icon there, and she must speak up.
Well, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee has come out to say that they won't revoke her Peace Prize, and that they don't, well, in short, select saints. Fuad says it doesn't surprise him at all.
It is not surprising. The same sort of scepticism could have been directed to Barack Obama's Nobel Prize as well. And a lot of it, I remember, was discussed around the fact that, you know, it's not really about honouring saints, but about honouring people in position of power who can make changes, who can inspire other people, so on and so forth. I mean, Henry Kissinger was a winner as well, and he was a war criminal. So it's not surprising that they reacted that way in many ways. It's always been a political gesture anyway, right? Nobel Prizes. So, I mean, this was harking back to the Cold War scenario where the Soviet bloc had the Lenin Prize and the liberal bloc had the Nobel Prize. So it's been ideological from the get-go.
So here's the question, right? Is the problem also with us, our expectations that perhaps politicians who have won the Nobel Prize, who are Nobel laureates, they have a certain sense of moral leadership, that they should be do-gooders for the rest of their careers. So we asked Fuad this.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is over-sentimentalized in the sense that we think by rescinding the prize or by, you know, these peace icons making statements that things might change. You know, I think it's important that they are held accountable, but it's not really where the real work has to happen. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's currently also happening in a digital media age where everybody has an opinion and these opinions travel really fast and Aung San Suu Kyi is just under the spotlight more so than any other leader in the past, especially given her position previously as a human rights advocate. You know, you can put people under a microscope more intensely now than, say, leaders in the past. So contextually, the intensity has a lot to do with how political discourse is taking place right now, too. So you're right, though. I think it's not so much about these figures or these icons. Of course, politicians are going to disappoint us, right? So we shouldn't really focus our energy on that necessarily. There are other ways to educate people. There are other ways to bring the message across.
Well, you know, there are people who have defended Aung San Suu Kyi's position. For instance, the former Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, he has come out to say that, you know, Myanmar has a long road ahead of it and that Aung San Suu Kyi perhaps needs more time. But the real question is, more time for what exactly?
Yeah, presumably to wheel and deal behind the scenes, to really work with the government mechanism or the deep state that isn't quite known to observers or to people who only follow mainstream politics, right? So the idea is that she could somehow use her influence politically behind the scenes. So, I mean, I've heard that argument, but it's a bit too risky in that deaths are happening every day and that the crisis is worsening the neighboring countries, you know? So it's a bit of a luxury to get her to wait at this point. The problem is not so much that Aung San Suu Kyi is silent or indifferent. The problem is that she's actually gone further to make statements against the Rohingyans, saying that they don't deserve citizenship, saying that the term shouldn't be used because the people don't really exist. So it's not really her passivity or her inability to do anything, but the fact that she's actually made very, very damning statements that can contribute to the situation worsening. So I'm not so sure if that's necessarily the best way forward, you know, in relation to how we should regard her or, you know, the question of moral leadership in general. There's a sense in which moral leadership requires less strategizing and more decisive action, and we're just not seeing from her.
That was Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the resident host of BFM's Night School. They're talking about moral leadership. Now, as I understand it, as of early this morning, Aung San Suu Kyi has said she will address Myanmar for the first time regarding this Rohingya crisis next week. So there's going to be a televised statement she's going to be making. But are words really enough, Ryan?
Yeah, because I think Fuad made a very good comment that basically right now, moral leadership is one thing. She needs to be a decisive leader. Now, what surprised me, interestingly enough, was Kevin Rudd coming up and defending
her.
Why
was that surprising?
Well, because, again, it's totally contrary to Australia's position. And I'm sure he'll be basically crucified for making those statements. But, yeah, it just came just off out of the blue for me in terms of, you know, a Western leader defending her.
Well, especially as you've got calls from many other kind of Nobel laureates who say, you know, that she should be doing something. For instance, I think that the strongest statement that I've seen, not just from Malala Yousafzai, but also Bishop Desmond Tutu, I think his open letter to Aung San Suu Kyi was really very kind of strongly worded. He said that If the political price of your ascension to the highest office in Myanmar is your silence, then the price is surely too steep.
Too steep, yeah, absolutely. Wow.
Okay, it's coming up to 16 minutes past 7. In just a few minutes, we're going to be taking a look at the front pages of the newspapers today. So stick with the Morning Run right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.